Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Mario Ritter, Phil Dierking, and Brian Lynn. Later, Katie Weaver will have this week's personal technology report. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
A United Nations report is warning that economic growth in Asian countries faces significant risk from rising levels of trade protectionism. It says experts are especially worried about United States trade policies with important trading partners such as China. The UN Economic and Social Commission for Asia and the Pacific report mainly says good things about Asian economies. Such countries are now responsible for about 30% of all trade worldwide. The report noted that the percentage could rise to 50% by 2050 if the economies continue expanding. Asia's export-led growth has helped millions of people escape poverty over the past 70 years. Many of the exported products are sold in the United States and Europe. But the UN report notes that in recent years, Asian economies have begun to depend on domestic demand because of the prolonged weakness in external demand and global trade. The UN economists are predicting that Asian economies will grow at a rate of close to 5% in 2017. They expect China's economy to expand 6.5% this year, with India's growing by 7.1%. The report described economic conditions in China as stable, and Russia's economy is expected to grow because of higher oil prices. But the report says trade protectionism could affect employment and economic growth. It described trade protectionism as the most significant risk to the broadly positive economic outlook. It noted recent changes in U.S. policies on trade, monetary exchange rates, and immigration. And it said negotiations on Britain's withdrawal from the European Union have increased concerns in many countries. The report said those worries could have a bad effect on Asia, including China's goods exports and India's services exports. During the U.S. election campaign last year, Donald Trump was very critical of China's trade and monetary policies. But after his election as president, Trump became less critical because he wanted support from China to stop North Korea's development of nuclear weapons. Shamshad Akhtar is the executive secretary of UNESCAP. She says the debate over protectionism and distrust of globalization need to be discussed. The UNESCAP report said growing global trade has helped many areas over the years. But opposition to globalization is growing in the United States, Europe, and other areas. People there are critical of free trade policies and companies moving jobs to overseas markets. The writers of the report warned of reduced economic growth in major developing countries if trade protectionism and global insecurity increase. They predicted a lowering of the growth rates by up to 1.2 percentage points. The report noted that the Asia-Pacific region remains the engine of global growth. But it said pay inequality is increasing and good jobs are difficult to find. It noted environmental damage was a major concern in some countries following years of economic expansion. It said the growth came at a huge cost to the environment. I'm Mario Ritter.
The matchmaking site IslamicMarriage.com helps Muslims around the world find partners through the internet. It is also becoming a recruiting tool for Islamic State terrorists. New Zealander Mark Taylor appears to be a usual single man. He has a dating profile on IslamicMarriage.com. It says he works as a teacher and has a good sense of humor. It also says he lives in Raqqa, Syria, a center of the Islamic State group. U.S. officials listed Taylor as an international terrorist earlier this year. He is one of several fighters in Syria and jihadist supporters in Europe and the U.S. with dating profiles on the website. On IslamicMarriage.com, Taylor calls himself Abu John Daniel. He says he arrived in Raqqa 10 months ago. The Middle East Media Research Institute is a policy research organization based in Washington, D.C. The group says it first noticed jihadist activity on IslamicMarriage.com last May. Anat Agron is a researcher there. She believes that efforts by social media sites to block IS militants, along with increased attention from Western intelligence agencies, forced some jihadists to turn to dating sites. Previously, Twitter and Facebook were more popular options for marrying off jihadists, Agron told VOA. I think that many realized these options were increasingly unsafe, and some folks probably got thrown in jail. IslamicMarriage.com is owned by the World Singles Group. Other World Singles sites include Arab World, Iranian Personals, and Eligible Greeks. Observers say that the jihadists' use of the dating site may suggest it is becoming harder for IS members to find people to marry. The number of mainly young Western and North African women traveling to Syria to marry fighters appears to have gone down, they say. It is not clear how many Western women have traveled to the area to become jihadi brides. Britain's Institute of Strategic Dialogue estimates the number at about 500.
Louise Lawrence Israels did not own many things during the 3 years she spent hiding from Nazis in Amsterdam. But she did possess a small toy chair. It was a gift for her second birthday, and it meant everything to Lawrence Israels. She kept it her entire time in hiding, not far from the house where Anne Frank wrote in her diary. Now, this chair is joining thousands of other artifacts at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum's new Conservation and Research Center. Donating the chair was not easy for Lawrence Israels, who is now 75 years old. "It was a big thing for me to actually give the chair," she said. "A lot of people can look at it and see how it was for a little child in hiding." More than 20 other Holocaust survivors joined Lawrence Israels for the center's opening. The David and Phyllis Chappelle Family Collections, Conservation, and Research Center is in Washington, D.C. It is a large, modern building with space for documents and artifacts, and a lot of room to grow. The artifacts at the center are kept in 8 climate-controlled rooms in a building designed to survive weather storms. The collection includes many artifacts of everyday objects, from children's toys and clothes to sewing machines used in concentration camps. Travis Roxlow, director of collection services, said center officials have spent 25 years gathering the items. "We collect stories, and all of the objects that go along with those stories, because as the surviving generation passes on, these are going to be the objects that are left to help us tell the history of the Holocaust," Roxlow said. For the survivors, they feel that protecting this collection of artifacts is important for preserving the reality of the Holocaust. "I think the most important thing is to make sure that the memory of the Holocaust isn't forgotten," said 75-year-old Alfred Munzer. Munzer donated a silver teething ring, which was with him at the age of 9 months, when he was hiding with a Dutch-Indonesian family in the Netherlands in 1942. He also donated 2 small pictures of him that his mother kept hidden while she was in concentration camps. According to Munzer, who currently lives in Washington, D.C., the center and its artifacts will serve as a lesson to the world as to where hate can lead to. The other Holocaust survivors are not going to be here forever, said Lawrence Israels. Once we're not here anymore, the museum and this institution will speak for us. She added, "This is the only evidence that we leave behind. And with the climate today, it's important that people see that this was real," she said. Researchers will be able to use the materials in the center. A reading room will open in the next year. The museum also is in the process of making documents and images available online. I'm Phil Dierking.
American inventor John Goodenough first started working on battery technology more than 40 years ago. Goodenough actually co-invented lithium-ion batteries in 1980. This eventually led to a revolution in the electronics industry, because those devices were smaller and provided more electricity than other fuel cells. Sony Corporation was the first business to commercially develop the lithium-ion technology. In 1991, Sony launched worldwide sales of lithium-ion batteries. They enabled the company to start producing small video cameras and other devices that soon became very popular. The same technology is still used today to power most personal devices. Now, John Goodenough is 94 years old. He continues working as an engineering professor at the University of Texas in Austin. Goodenough recently announced what he believes is another major development in battery technology. He and his engineering team have produced the first-ever solid-state battery cells. He hopes this latest invention will shake up the electronics world. Researchers say the new solid-state batteries can hold more power, charge faster, and do not get as hot as ones currently in use. They have at least three times as much energy density as today's lithium-ion batteries, notes Goodenough. He said the main difference between the old and new technology is that the latest battery cells use parts made of glass instead of liquid. I was trying to improve the lithium-ion battery that you use in your cell telephone that has several problems, Goodenough said, explaining how he made the discovery. He said a big problem with liquid parts is they can catch fire under some conditions. John Goodenough said his latest discovery also has the possibility to solve many other problems with current batteries. These include cost, energy density, rates of charge and discharge, and battery life. While his first invention helped start a wireless revolution, he hopes the latest one will help support many forms of sustainable energy. The goal is to use the new batteries to store energy produced by renewable sources, such as the sun and wind. This energy could then be used to run electric vehicles or to provide power for homes.
The rechargeable battery is the most convenient way to store electric power. It can be stored either as stationary storage for the grid, or it can be stored in portable batteries for electric cars and for many other applications.
Goodenough is a big supporter of electric-powered cars. He first got interested in them during America's energy crisis in the 1970s. But one of the major issues slowing their development over the years has been the lack of powerful, low-cost, long-lasting batteries. He believes his new technology can provide major improvements for electric cars in the future. He said the current vehicles have a long way to go to meet the high demands of drivers.
They'd like to have a car that would be as convenient as your modern car, have a bigger driving range. You'd like to be able to charge it very quickly, maximum 10 minutes. They would like it to be no more expensive than your present car is. At the present moment, you're just not quite able to reach that goal, and I'm hoping that what we've developed will allow us to reach that goal.
John Goodenough said he believes there is great potential for his new batteries to be widely used in phones and other personal devices. But to be truly successful, the technology will also have to effectively compete with energy that comes from fossil fuels. Reducing the use of oil can greatly lower energy costs and cut air pollution and climate change, he added. Goodenough has received many awards for his work, including the National Medal of Science from President Barack Obama in 2011. But he has not gotten rich from any of his discoveries.
I've never made any money from the inventions we have. The lawyers have always taken all the money. And I'm too old to worry about it, nor did I ever worry about it too much. As long as I have a job, that's all I needed to keep me with a roof over my head and eating and an opportunity to work.
His team has asked the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office for legal rights to the technology. The invention is considered intellectual property owned by the University of Texas at Austin's Cockrell School of Engineering. The university plans to oversee efforts to offer the technology to companies that will keep developing it. Goodenough gives much of the credit for his success to the people around him. I'm very happy to have nice people to work with. You don't do anything alone, you do it with people, he said. Most scientists would feel very lucky to get just one major breakthrough during their lifetime. Goodenough said he feels thankful that he now has a second chance. But at age 94, he said he's not sure how many more of these he will get.
If the good Lord brings things together and I'm at the right man at the right time, well, who knows what can happen? You can't predict.
I'm Brian Lynn.
Two weeks ago, we reported about developments with electric planes and flying cars. That technology could bring change to commercial and personal travel. Last week, two companies, Kitty Hawk and Uber, announced their plans to bring flying cars to reality very soon. Sooner than you think, flying cars may appear in the skies. Imagine never having to worry about traffic, stoplights, or road construction. A flying car could get somewhere much faster than one traveling by road. On the other hand, imagine having to avoid drones and other flying cars. Also, what if your battery dies when you are in the air? And how will you know where to land? Kitty Hawk is a startup tech company supported by Google co-founder Larry Page. Kitty Hawk president Sebastian Thrun helped start Google's self-driving car project. Thrun announced Kitty Hawk's flying car plans last Monday in a tweet. The car is electric-powered and moved by 8 rotor blades. Kitty Hawk wants people to be able to buy its flying car by the end of 2017. According to the Kitty Hawk website, the car will be able to travel at speeds up to 40 kilometers an hour. It says under U.S. aviation law, such a machine does not require registration or a pilot's license and may be flown in uncongested areas for recreational purposes. As of now, the car can only be flown over fresh water. Kitty Hawk is making a list of people interested in buying the flying car. They must pay a deposit of $100. Those who get their names on the list early will receive $2,000 off the final cost of the car. However, Kitty Hawk has not yet announced the price. Kitty Hawk expects its first flying cars will go on sale by the end of this year. At a conference last week, Uber announced plans for flying taxis to begin carrying passengers. The company expects to launch flying fleets in Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas, and Dubai in the United Arab Emirates by 2020. Unlike the Kitty Hawk company, Uber does not plan to build flying cars. Instead, it will use the resources of partner companies. Like the Kitty Hawk car, Uber flying taxis will use electric power. Uber says its flying taxis could travel up to 241 kilometers an hour. The company said that could reduce the travel time between San Francisco and San Jose, California, from 2 hours on the road to 15 minutes in the air. Riders could use the Uber app to book a flying taxi to take them to their destinations. The company has not yet said how costly air taxi travel would be compared to road taxi travel. I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.